Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Welcome to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm your host, Justin Kaufman. Tonight, we talk the talk. It's a loose theme around the various segments in tonight's show. We explore action, inaction, loyalty, and legacy. And for good measure, we head to East Garfield Park for another one of our neighborhood conversations. For instance, tonight, Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot is facing criticism for about-face on Lincoln Yards in the 78. Today, she removed her opposition to delaying the vote for public funds. And instead, she's okay with the projects moving forward. This is a bit of a turnaround from the blustery talk on the campaign trail, political strategy, or rookie mistake as she starts her tenure as the reform mayor. It was 10 years ago that Ken Davis organized a news summit to talk about the issues facing old and new media in town. The outgrowth, a talk show on CAN TV about those issues and more. Yesterday, Ken Davis announced the Chicago Newsroom will be ending. We'll talk with him about his run with the show. Here's another way to incorporate tonight's theme. Talk the talk. How about those whose job it is to talk and to listen? Therapist Lori Gottlieb will join me in the 8 o'clock hour to talk about the hidden secrets of therapy, but also her own story, which took her from therapist to patient. It's called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. We'll have that conversation coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. And it's record store day this weekend, so we'll talk to the family that owned arguably the best record store in Chicago history, Wax Trax in Lincoln Park. We talk about that history and a bit of a rebirth with Julia Nash, the daughter of founder Jim Nash, the documentary coming out as well. And East Garfield Park is our next stop on the neighborhood tour. Former mayoral candidate Amara Enya lives there, and she takes us to a local place that's all about the West Side. Now it's time to walk the walk. It's Extension 720. Stay with us. But first, tonight's theme, you talk the talk. We do put a premium on words, don't we? But we put more of a premium on backing up those words with action. We're seeing that play out in D.C., where our president seems to talk the talk and talk the talk some more. And then we argue with conviction about whether or not those words have any meaning. It's funny. Today, think of the black hole. A black hole was photographed today for the first time, proving its existence. The science community knew they existed because all the theories made sense, but it wasn't until today that we officially can say that Albert Einstein both talked the talk and walked the walk. He was right, even if it was 103 years ago. Or, you know, Johnson Publishing. Story came out today. John Johnson started his media company 77 years ago. Instead of just talking about the need for a publication to tell black stories, Johnson created one. Ebony Jet was one of the premier African-American companies in America, right here in Chicago. Today, it officially ended. So 103 years, 77 years, historic examples. Is there a statute of limitations, though, when it comes to backing up your words? Because I can think of a fresher example.
The reason I have opposed it is multifaceted. Number one, this is a mega project in the middle of Lincoln Park that is going to completely transform those neighborhoods. Unfortunately, though, there hasn't been enough transparency around the transportation impacts, the infrastructure impacts, what's going to be the impacts on the local schools. If you travel in that area now, it's almost impassable going east to west, and yet the developers have not provided the kind of information about those kinds of impacts to the community's satisfaction. I think that's a fundamental problem.
Hasn't that train left the station in terms of community input and so forth?
No, I do not think so. And if I'm mayor, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that the final I isn't dotted and the final T isn't crossed until that disclosure is made.
That was a TTW debate back in March where Mayor-elect Lightfoot talked about her opposition to the Lincoln Yards development. Today, the mayor-elect gave her blessing for the lame duck city council to approve taxpayer funds for mega developments Lincoln Yards and the 78. It was met with protests, including sit-downs on LaSalle Street in front of City Hall. Protesters were joined by several of the new aldermen-elect who also opposed these developments and ran on that.
Look, the council could have done this without her blessing, and we're poised to do it regardless. But we do put a premium on words, and there were plenty of words in the last 3 months. So the big question, are we witnessing a one-off flip-flop? Do we give the mayor-elect the benefit of the doubt that she did what she said? She dotted the I's, she crossed the T's, and she pushed for transparency for those communities involved. Or is it that the mayor-elect might have said whatever was needed to be said to tap a city's desire for change, to win a hotly contested mayor's race? Whichever the case, this won't be the last time Lightfoot will run up against her own words. But I'm not sure Chicago is going to give her 103 years to prove it. Because if you talk the talk... So tonight here in Extension 720, take a quick break. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about City Council today with Heather Sharone. So stay with us. It is Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Heather Sharone coming up here in a moment. We're going to talk to her about what happened today at City Council, the first. It's kind of interesting because Lori Lightfoot is not the mayor yet. She doesn't get sworn in until the beginning of May. So I had to stop myself short right there as I was about to say Mayor-elect Lightfoot's first city council meeting because it kind of felt like it was. Obviously, she was downstate this today talking to the State House in Springfield. But all eyes on her and her decision to publicly back Mayor Emanuel's plans for TIF funds for Lincoln Yards, and for the 78. Heather Sharone, of course, managing editor at the Daily Line. She joins us on the line now. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Justin. It was quite a day at City Hall.
Yeah, I felt like I wanted to say Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot's first day at City Council, but this is the end of Rahm Emanuel's. But she overshadowed a lot of Emanuel today at the council.
She really did, and it was a crazy week of late night statements and things changing really just by the hour, if not the second. But what's, you know, sort of, I guess, the ultimate is that we ended up exactly where we thought we would, you know, a couple weeks ago, about a month ago, with the city have approving roughly $1.6 billion in subsidies for
wow.
two massive projects that will really reshape Chicago as we know it.
There was a lot, and we kind of talked, the episode is called Talk the Talk, and there's a question on the table right now just about, we're so early in, and we really officially aren't even into her tenure yet, but there's a little bit of questions about on the campaign trail. She was up front talking to activists and others about delaying this vote or really taking a look at what is involved with Lincoln Yards and the 78. So did the activists and the protesters and people at City Hall, including community activists, do they feel betrayed at this moment?
I think they do, and I think it's an open question about whether they should. So what developed today was that Mayor-elect Lightfoot essentially negotiated more money within those projects, the 78 and Lincoln Yards, that will have to go to minority-owned business. So businesses owned by African-Americans and Latinos and also women. So the city's rules right now say 26% of projects have to go to those firms and 6% have to go to women-owned firms. Lori Lightfoot said, nope, that's not good enough, and so she changed the agreement to 30% for Black and Latino-owned firms and 10% for women-owned firms. So, whether or not that sort of changes the underlying sort of structure of the deal. I don't think it's accurate to say that. But I think Lori Lightfoot could probably say, look, I did everything that I could to make this the best deal possible, keeping in mind that I'm not actually mayor yet, and there were a significant number of aldermen who wanted to approve this. Not only Brian right. Hopkins, whose second ward includes Lincoln Yards, but a lot of South and West Side aldermen who see these projects as providing the jobs that will move their residents into the middle class, either through construction jobs or, you know, to get these, you know, massive projects built, or, you know, service jobs once they're built in terms of offices or shops or stores. So that was a lot of, you know, pressure to get this through. But it's not a mistake that this went through at Rahm Emanuel's last city council meeting.
That's amazing.
Yeah. He certainly went out with a bang. There's no doubt about that.
And I want to get to what happened on the floor with the tributes to Emanuel. This was his last city council meeting. But, you know, back to this idea of, you know, there were 30-plus aldermen that voted for both of these projects. And you're right. There were a lot of South and West Side aldermen who feel like this is good for their communities. One of the voices that seems to be, muffled, would be the voices of the people in closest to Lincoln Yards. And that would be the areas of Bucktown, Wicker Park, on the other side, Lincoln Park. There have been staunch opposition to this just because of the headaches it's going to cause for infrastructure and for traffic. They don't seem to be represented here because both of the aldermen there voted no, but their votes don't really mean anything.
You're absolutely correct. So, you know, I know I'm sort of going off topic a little bit here, but last time the city council redrew its ward maps, this area was removed from Alderman Scott Wagstaff's 32nd ward and put into the second ward. And Alderman Scott Wagstaff led the opposition to Lincoln Yards. And that, if you think, was a mistake, I have also a bridge in Brooklyn I would like to sell to you. So that's going to be a big fight after the 2020 census, but it tells you sort of how long this has sort of been in the works and sort of looking out there. But it was a very odd situation to have one alderman have the entire development and have the two neighboring aldermen, Wagstaff and Michelle Smith, who represents Lincoln Park, vehemently against it, because their residents are going to be the ones that are stuck in the traffic potentially. And, you know,
it's also their TIF money, correct? I mean,
well, so TIF is really complicated, but essentially this property, which used to be part of the Finkel Steel site and the city's Maiton Yards, is essentially worthless, according to the Cook County Assessor right now. And so when Lincoln Yards starts building all of these buildings, that value will grow exponentially. Now, if there was no TIF, all of that tax money would go sort of into the city's general fund, mm-hmm. and the city could do whatever it wanted to. But this TIF means that tax money will instead go back to Sterling Bay to reimburse the developer for building all those roads and bridges and that sort of thing. Right. So, you know,
Heather, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just feel like even at the beginning of that premise, this concept that land at Finkel Steel is worthless, is worth nothing. When you think about exactly where that's at Armitage and North Avenue and right along the heartbeat of the north side of Chicago, it already stinks. I know that, you know, there's a lot that goes into that, but I think that's the problem with the opposition, is that there are these little things like that, like saying that land is worthless. Everybody knows. Anyone who goes anywhere near that is not worthless land.
Yeah. Well, there's no argument that it's a really sort of odd thing, you know, just on its face, for the city to be sort of putting all of this taxpayer money into what everybody says is the hottest real estate in Chicago. And the idea is that if it wasn't for the TIF, this land wouldn't develop, and that is very much an open question, because so many people want to live right by the river between Lincoln Yards and Bucktown. It's a really happening place. So that was really what it came down to. But you know, we've talked a little in the past about aldermanic prerogative, and it's a longstanding tradition that because the local alderman wanted it to get done and the mayor supported it, it got done, regardless of what sort of Lori Lightfoot tried to do looking into the windows of City Hall.
Okay, so let me ask this, because really this is a political question. Essentially signing off on this, which you saw the floor leader at City Council and Pat O'Connor said, we won't even vote on it if Lori Lightfoot says she doesn't want to do it. By signing on to this, doing the midnight statement and owning it and almost sharing the result with Mayor Emanuel, who's leaving, is what do you mean? What do you make of that politically? Because, you know, you saw in the last big major project, and I kind of make, I guess, comparisons to the parking meter deal, where that was a Mayor Daley deal, and Rahm Emanuel was able to come in and say, "This is not my deal, but I'll help fix it." And does Lori Lightfoot lose anything by being there and being the person who says, "I give you my blessing"?
And I think that she was in a really sort of damned if she did and damned if she didn't, because I'm not convinced that you know, Mayor Emanuel really wanted this to stop. He said today that had she asked, you know, directly, no vote today, he would have agreed with that. I don't know if Alderman would have gone along with that. Brian Hopkins basically said, "I don't care what the mayor says." So, you know, I guess what she tried to do, and when I spoke to her, sort of her staff today, they said, "We tried hard to be pragmatic. You know, we didn't think we could stop it. The votes were there. We tried to make the deal a little bit better in the way that we, you know, in any way that we could, you know, judge us on that." But, you know, her biggest problem, much like J.B. Pritzker when he took over as Illinois governor, is going to be convincing the progressive, left-leaning wing of the Democratic Party that she is one of them, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
Allowing Lincoln Yards to go through, you know, with whatever level of blessing she actually gave it, complicates that project. Had she been able to stop it, I think she could have said, you know, there's your answer. And she can't do that right now.
Well, it seems like on the campaign trail, she did a good job of convincing voters she was progressive, because that's who the progressives went for. But I digress. Let's talk about just because we have about a minute left here. Rahm Emanuel's last city council meeting, aldermen standing up and giving their tributes. What's your takeaway from the final city council meeting for Rahm Emanuel?
Oh, it was one for the record books. And I think the award has got to go to Alderman Walter Burnett of the 27th Ward, who broke down in tears and then proclaimed that he was going to give, you know, Rahm Emanuel the highest honor he could. And he said, "You a hustler, man, in a good way, a hustler." And I got to say that just, you know, it really sums up just sort of the whole deal. It was also a sort of awkward because there were aldermen who are leaving who were not mentioned. Alderman Danny Solis wasn't there because he's been disgraced. Alderman Ricardo Munoz did not get a send-off because he is facing domestic violence charges. And Alderman Willie Cochran was removed from council a couple of weeks ago when he pled guilty to corruption charges. So there was an undercurrent of, gosh, this is really awkward. But, you know, these aldermen supported Rahm Emanuel. They pushed his projects through, and he rewarded them not only with attention and help on, you know, things they wanted to do, but he gave them a lot of campaign cash. And some of them survived to live another term, and some of them did not.
Of course. One of the best in the business, Heather Sharone, managing editor at The Daily Line. Heather, thanks for joining us tonight.
Always. Thanks, Justin.
Back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Thanks, Andrea. That news is sponsored by Tortoise Supper Club. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, Lori Gottlieb's going to be here. She's got her book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed what happens when Lori, a therapist herself, has a life-changing event and she has to go to therapy. That's what the book's about. It really is a really interesting look at the industry as a whole and what therapists are trying to get out of you when you go in there. So that's the conversation we're coming up at 8 o'clock in our episode tonight. We're calling Talk the Talk. 9 years ago, journalist Ken Davis started a show on CAN-TV called Chicago Newsroom. It was a panel show that invited people to the studio to talk about what was happening in Chicago. Pretty simple concept that turned into a juggernaut. 400-plus episodes later, Davis is ready to hang it up. He announced yesterday that he's ending Chicago Newsroom at the end of May. Ken has interviewed newsmakers, journalists, and community leaders since he started back in 2010. The idea actually came out of a now-legendary symposium that Ken helped create on the future of media in Chicago. At the time, there was so much uncertainty and misinformation when it came to print versus digital world. Now, of course, that's all cleared up. So Ken can hang it up, right? He's in studio to talk about Chicago Newsroom. Ken, great to see you, and congratulations.
Thanks, you're going to make me cry.
It's a great...
The Chicago's just getting over losing Wally Phillips, and now Chicago
Newsroom. Yeah. Why do you want to walk away from 9 years? Why not just keep going with
it? Here, before we get started... Let me unwrap this here. Yeah.
Look at this.
You never got a Chicago Newsroom mug. So
I feel like
I want you to have that.
This is great. I'll take it. I'll get rid of my WGN mug, which is missing the G in it, but that's all right. Thank you. So why this decision?
Well, you know what? I don't even know. I mean, when I talked to Rob Feeder, I actually quoted Rich Daly because I went back to look at when we started and all the, you know, the feed comes up and it's the day 2 days after Rich Daly made the announcement. And I read his statement and it's like, yeah, that's kind of the way I feel. It's like, no particular reason. I just think it's time. Of course, I don't have a parking meter deal to run away from or anything, but, you know, it's just, anyway, you know what it was? What started it was I thought we had an opportunity. And I think maybe we took a little bit of it, that opportunity. We were just beginning to see the first vestiges of the live dashboard in cars, right? We were beginning to see YouTube. I mean, YouTube had been around for a while, but we were finally seeing it to the point where it was robust enough mm-hmm. that you could really use it. SoundCloud was coming online. All of these kind of... this is kind of like the conversation you were having last night about the future of media. But,
yeah.
But it looked to me... Like you wouldn't need. Look, I didn't have the to be perfectly frank, the talent to be on a big radio station, but I wanted to do something that talked about all the issues that were going on, and I didn't think there was enough of it happening in the media. So I thought, hey, you know what? You don't need a radio station anymore. You can do this thing. Set it up at CanTV. You can do these live feeds, and you can also. For the first time, you can do time shifting in audio yeah. that really matters.
So that was really it. The conceit, this idea that you would use CanTV to, of course, record it, and it would play on CanTV community television here in Chicago. But the real goal was to disseminate the show and the information online through right. YouTube and other places.
And that's what I think has happened. I mean, it has an audience on CanTV, and I am in. Intensely grateful to CanTV for letting me have this. But the real thing was that it began to create a life of its own. You know, sometimes we'd get 500-700 hits on mm-hmm. on YouTube alone. You made an appearance once where we got a thousand within.
We broke a thousand?
Broke a thousand yeah. for the first time.
That's yeah. what I guarantee to the media entities in Chicago. I'll break a thousand on YouTube. That's
right,
it.
Yeah. So it was a chance to prove to myself and others that you could do serious discussion about the week's news and not have a television or radio station, but you could do it basically online and in the virtual world.
From your perch at Chicago Newsroom to cover Chicago news for 10 years, mm-hmm. and I've noticed this too from just my experiences in talk radio for the last couple decades, but do you see the stories evolve? Or is it cyclical? Are you in year six talking about the same thing you talked about in year one and year eight? It just feels like maybe there's five or seven stories that we find different ways to talk about.
You know, this is one of the many problems of becoming an older man, an older gentleman, is that you're having these conversations and you're saying, yeah, you know, I remember when Harold said, oh, shut up, Ken, will you stop with the 30-year-old references? But it is true. The issues that we're talking about disinvestment, racist policies of the city government and everything else, they never go away. I mean, 40 years ago, the Sun-Times did the story about how the parks in Chicago were being segregated and only the resources were going to the north side, nothing to the west and south. Those stories just don't ever seem to go away. So you have to just keep reporting them, hoping that maybe you chip away at them or something.
Well, one of the things I always admired about your work on Chicago Newsroom is that you gave opportunity to some of the voices that weren't heard, whether it be a young reporter or someone who was working in the community. But it wasn't just going to, and we see this far too often, where if there's going to be a panel show where there's two or three people talking about the news, it's going to be someone from the Tribune, someone from the Sun-Times, and it's just over and over. That's just how it's the format of it. But for you, there was a lot of introducing us to voices and people I've used on these shows that I didn't know before.
Yeah, well, I you're absolutely right, and I'm not going to sit here and say that I think we succeeded at it, but it was our mantra. It was the thing that we wanted to do was let's try to find who the new voices are and let's shine even if it's only a small spotlight, let's at least put a spotlight on them. And you know, when you talk about what used to be Alder Track, it's now the Daily Line. Mm-hmm. Heather, you just had Heather on the air. I mean, I am just a major fan of Heather Sharon and all of her compatriots. They are young, they're energetic, and again, making an old man reference, I've been in the City Hall press box for city council meetings in the last year or two, and you sit behind these guys who are sitting with a laptop with a screen with like five compartments on it. They're tweeting, they're writing their story, they're looking up and finding references, doing Facebook, all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I'm standing behind them and thinking, you know, I once thought that I could do this job, but I mean, it's really literally true. This is a new generation with a new approach, with new tools. They're using those tools very well. I don't have to feel ashamed of the fact that I don't know those tools as well. What we need to do is make sure that they get elevated, make sure that they get noticed.
And there's something about, and this was a big part of the conversation you had about the future of the news media back in 29. It was at one of the hotels in town. He had brought together all the different editors and reporters and people were in the all in the same room. It was
in the same room that used to be the smoke-filled room. I was very important, very you know, at the I forgot the name of the hotel now, but the one across the street from City Hall.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, that's where all the deals were cut. So I thought that would be a great
thing. That's a good place.
Let's rent that room.
But that was all about how do we all get along when it comes to the traditional print and the digital reporters that are coming up, but also learn from each other about what it takes to actually cover the news and develop and deliver product to people. That was 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was over 10 years
ago. And
actually,
Chicago Newsroom was an outgrowth of that. Yeah. So, you know, that's, I think, for the remainder of our time, which is until 8 o'clock, we should talk about that.
Don't,
I mean, it's been 10 years.
Talk about the remainder of my time.
The remainder of your time. Let's just start right there. I mean, the premise, I got the premise right, so it's been 10 years.
Yeah.
How do you feel like Chicago's ecosystem when it comes to the news has evolved?
Oh, I mean, you know, this is a 12-hour conversation, and I love this conversation more than any other. One of the big things that happened at that that I was totally unprepared for, it was a two-hour conversation. We had a panel of 13 people up on the stage, and it just very quickly divided along age lines. And there were a lot of younger people there who were just coming up, or they had started online presences of various kinds. And as I said afterward, the theme of it ended up being, if you idiots would just hurry up and die, we could take over and the world would be perfect. Unfortunately, many of those folks, and I don't say this with glee, a lot of those folks, their enterprises went by the wayside because there wasn't enough money to support them. There wasn't a large enough audience to support them. And, you know, the legacy guys, what is this? WGN. Oh, yes. Good old W. You know, the legacy guys seem to be doing fairly well. I mean, they in many cases, the big operators have adapted. We're seeing the Sun-Times still alive, which nobody would have predicted 2 years ago, and growing and getting more digital every day. And what's happened is that a lot of the legacy folk learned a lot from these younger, more energetic entrepreneurs who were carping on how everything's got to be online. So lessons have been learned. We're in a healthier ecosystem than I think we were before, where something like the Daily Line or Southside Weekly and you know, the Chicago Bureau can all exist in this ecosphere. And some of them are starting to get serious money. So it's really, I'm optimistic, and I never thought I would have said that 2-3 years ago.
Well, we'll continue the conversation. Ken Davis is here, Chicago Newsroom, which can be found on CAN TV and as well on YouTube and online and social media, is wrapping up.
Wrapping it up.
I don't know what, like, hanging. I said hanging it up earlier. You kind of grimaced at that.
No. I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
I'm walking away from it. That's
walking away. Yeah. May 30th is the
while
final.
While I still can walk.
You can still walk. Ken Davis, my guest on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Ken Davis is in studio with me, the host of Chicago Newsroom. He is calling it quits coming up on the end of May. And we're talking about the health and the ecosystem here of news media in Chicago. It was 10 years ago that Ken and others convened a big discussion to talk about the old and the new, talk about the print versus digital, and get everybody on the same page. As you mentioned, many of those companies aren't around anymore, whether that be Gaper's Block, Chicagoist, which is now owned by Chance the Rapper. Yeah. Other entities, it was the Chicago News Co-op.
The Chicago News Co-op. That actually started just almost, I think, only a few months after the Journalism Town Hall. But Now, there's a, you know, we wouldn't want to get into long discussions about individual things, but there's an example of somebody or of an organization that tried to be new and digital by mimicking an old model.
Right.
And it didn't work.
And there was a lot, and there was this concept that I think has come and gone, which was this not-for-profit journalism. This concept that they were going to raise money from grants and other places.
Well, don't say that's a ProPublica.
Yeah, but there are, that's a great point. Even though you could say Chicago News Co-op is no longer, the seeds were planted for places like ProPublica or for Block Club, which goes straight to, and takes on a more, I think, authentic digital approach, which is like pledge drives from public radio.
Well, I think some of it has to do with a clearer understanding of your distribution model and your distribution mechanism, right? I mean, if you're going to be an all digital operation, then you've got to think all digital. You can't pretend that you're a newspaper. If you're still printing a newspaper, you have certain things that you have to do, and you have to adapt to it. You've given up a long time ago on breaking news in your pages, so you become more magazine like. Whatever, everybody's adapting in a lot of ways. You know, as we mentioned before, these great legacy radio stations in Chicago, their audiences are not what they used to be, but they're still really good. And that means something.
And so, I would say, too, and one of the secrets in the business is that, whether it be, you'll hear me every time at the top of this hour say, tell your device to listen to WGN Radio. Right. Or, and you think about the way that we are monitored and how we are, the metrics and how we are rated.
Yeah.
They don't include all the different digital products the different streams and things like that.
Well, I mean, let's look at your show. I don't, honestly, to be very honest, I don't listen very often, but I listen all the time to the podcast, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a podcast listener because I can listen to it when I want to, and it's all condensed. I can listen to the thing that I want to listen to. So here's an example of one of the oldest legacy radio stations adapting to the reality that its audience wants to time shift. This is what television went through 10 years ago. This is what HBO and everything else did to television.
Right. And now,
Netflix.
I can't tell you the last time I actually watched a show on television in real time.
Right.
That's not something that I do.
But we still have television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
You know? And we still have radio.
When we think about the print world and digital immersion, if you will. The Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times have had lifetimes since you had the journalism town hall.
Yeah.
And both of those lifetimes included Michael Farah, who came in. There seemed to be a movement in the last decade to have more startup entrepreneurs buy newspapers and to come in and say, this is what we're going to do. We're going to repackage it and be digital and do this and do that. Why didn't it work?
Why didn't it work? Well, I think the main reason it didn't work is because we weren't able to see the future. We couldn't see 6 weeks into the future, let alone 6 years, right? If the people who were running these agencies could see what we know today, they would have adapted much more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But, when you have a multi-billion-dollar corporation that's based on doing what you've always been doing, it's really hard to turn that ship around.
I wonder, too, about, because one of the things that I always wondered, take the Sun-Times, for example, when it was under Michael Farah.
Yeah.
There was all this talk about doing a national website ring, together, and they were going to do a lot of distribution that was different than we were used to, and wait till you see this website design, and wait till you see this feed.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it came out, you were underwhelmed.
Right.
And you were that to me
and
was...
And what they didn't know, sorry for interrupting,
no.
What they didn't know was that at this very same time, Facebook was figuring out a way to take over the world. And they took over the world of distribution of news content almost overnight. Mm. Nobody really saw it coming. And then the next thing you know, you're paying Facebook to publish the stuff that you just paid reporters to report.
If you were going to do a journalism town hall like you did, which you should... And 10 years later, I would come, But I think that you would have a different premise instead of how do you get along. It would be, how does Chicago News deal with Facebook?
Right.
And it is interesting.
Maybe not. Maybe that's over. Maybe it's something. Listen, folks, go back and listen to Justin's show from last night. I can't remember the guy.
Roderick Alemania. Yeah.
This was an amazing conversation you guys had last night about how the thing that is really taking over social media is this esports model.
Right.
But I'm not into sports, or gaming. I'm too old for that gaming thing. We're talking about how generations are layered out.
Yeah.
But what he was really talking about was this is the next thing.
He's talking about data.
It's data.
Yeah.
You sell your data to a big corporation, and they give you stuff in return.
What has happened in the last 10 years, and that was what was interesting last night, this is what the esports people have figured out, is that in the last 10 years, they've been stealth about that.
Right.
A Facebook, a Twitter, whatever. They're lifting your data and not telling you about it. The esports world has said, you're smart. We know.
Right.
So if you want, we're going to get, your data is worth something.
Right.
We'll pay for it.
And young people don't care. They say, sure, take
my
data.
Or they know that
you're going to give me something.
They know that's how the world works.
Right. So I'm driving around listening to this last night, and I'm thinking, my God, it's like, this is like revolution number 3 that I've lived through in the last 10 or 15 years. How does news adapt to that?
Right.
How does the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times deal with an environment where people are online all the time, they're talking to each other, and they're just giving all this data, and you're expected to give them something back? Could you give them back a news story, maybe?
Or possibly, and again, this I'm not even thinking about how we would. We're going to have to. Well, I don't know. I was going to say
time
is up. Time is up.
We're
thank you, Ken
time.
Davis. But it is let's do this. Let's continue the conversation, Ken. We'll get some more people and continue because that is a great point about what's next
for news industries
to deal with data because it's going to be readily available.
Absolutely,
Ken Davis, the host of Chicago Newsroom on CAN TV, which is wrapping up at the end of May. Congratulations on a great run.
We're out of time,
and we look forward to more from Ken Davis here in Chicago. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the theme of tonight's show is Talk the Talk, which is perfect for my next guest. Lori Gottlieb is a therapist. She does the Dear Therapist advice column for The Atlantic. She writes for several publications. She's a New York Times bestseller. But for this story, for this interview, Lori went from therapist to patient. After a breakup, Lori recognized she needed someone to talk to, so she signed up to talk with Wendell. And what she learned about her breakup, her relationship, and her outlook changed her life forever. The book is called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. It's a heartfelt look at therapy and how therapists approach their craft and struggle with getting out of their own way, just like the rest of us. Lori Gottlieb in studio. Lori, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
There's something really great about this being part memoir and part clinical guide to understanding how therapy works. Why do it that way? Why tell your story through also giving some of the trade secrets of how you operate and work?
Well, I really wanted to demystify what therapy is, so I didn't want us to have trade secrets. I didn't want to be the wizards. I think that keeps a lot of people from getting help because they have a lot of misconceptions about what therapy is. It's really this very rich human experience. And I wanted to bring in people to the therapy room so they could see for themselves through the stories of my patients. So we follow 4 main patients throughout the book who are very different from one another. And then I'm the 5th patient because I'm going to therapy as well.
There's 2 parts to this. There's the one of you as a therapist really engaging and trying to let yourself go to be a patient. But the other part of this, too, is you as a therapist learning how to interact with your patients or grow with your patients. Which do you gravitate more to in this story?
I think both. I think they're both different, and they're both... I say in the book that we grow in connection with others, and I think as clinician, I grow in connection with my patients just as my patients grow in connection with me, and the same thing when I'm a patient in my therapy with Wendell. And I think that you can see both sides of just the shared human experience that we're all more the same than we are different. And you can see that by what I talk about in therapy and what my patients talk about. You might not relate to the people on the surface, but I think we can all find aspects of ourselves in all of these stories. And stories are the ways that we make sense of our lives.
That's so true. For you, you talked about right at the beginning just this idea of demystifying therapy. Did you have to demystify yourself in the sense that you knew how to be a therapist, but maybe not a patient?
I think that when you're sitting on the patient's side, you do all the things that patients do, even though you know better. So when I see somebody in the waiting room, when I leave, I wonder, you know, my session was a downer. I wonder if he's looking forward to her session more. Or I wondered if he liked me. And one night I Googled him because I was really curious about his life. And I know that patients Google me because they'll slip up inevitably. You know, they'll say things like, well, you know what it's like raising a middle school boy, even though I've never mentioned my son or his gender or his age.
What do you think that is? Why do you think people want to do that? Because there is some love of the anonymity, the idea that I don't need to have a relationship with you outside. But what do you think it is about patients who want to know more about their therapist?
I think it's hard to have this deep, intimate relationship with somebody and not know a lot about them. And I think on the one hand, we want to know, but on the other hand, we really don't. So I write in the book about a colleague of mine who she and her husband had been having fertility problems and they were really trying hard to have a baby and had had all this heartbreak. And she was finally pregnant and she was standing in a Starbucks when she got a call from her doctor that the pregnancy wasn't viable. And she burst into sobs in the Starbucks. And a patient happened to walk in at that moment, made eye contact with her, left, and never came back. And so I think it's almost like we want our therapist to be human, but we don't want to see their humanity.
And that is throughout the book, and that's a big part of this. Let's catch up with your story. So a practicing therapist, and you go through a breakup. You decide you want therapy. Take us from there to the moments that you met Wendell.
I met Wendell because there was an unexpected breakup, and I was sure, as my friends had assured me, that I dodged a bullet with the boyfriend. And that was my story, and I was sticking to it. And when I got to Wendell, you know, he very much didn't do what my friends did. I write in the book about the difference between idiot compassion and wise compassion. And idiot compassion is what we do with our friends. You're right. You dodged a bullet. We support them. You know, yes, your boss is a jerk. Yes, your partner did this.
You were looking for validation.
I was looking for validation because I was so sure that I was in the right. But at the same time, I think what he did, which is what therapists do, is they offer wise compassion, which is we hold up a mirror to people to help them see a reflection of themselves in a way that they can't. We all have blind spots, and we all have ways that we shoot ourselves in the foot over and over and end up in the same situation. And that's what a good therapist will do. Friends tend to, you know, help you feel better in the short term, but maybe it's not so helpful in the long term.
That's so interesting, too, because you think about almost, and you talk about this not only in the book, but also in a couple articles in The Atlantic, just about this idea of who we are and how we present ourselves to the world, but also then even as we have conversations with our therapists, we're presenting ourselves. This is our take. I want to make sure you know that I was in the right.
That's
or what
right.
It might be. Yeah.
That's right. And so when people come in, I'm listening to their story, but I'm also listening to how flexible they are with their story. What if the other people in the story were to tell their version of the story? What are we missing here? So I know that what I'm hearing is just one person's version of a story, and they're gunning for me to take a particular position. And I can say that because as the patient, I did exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I have it written down. I just looked down to say, I just have the note, unreliable narrators. That's the concept, right?
But yes.
The beauty of this book, and what's I think is really attractive about it, is that you are coming into it with much more information and understanding of the relationship between therapist patients. So in a way, you're almost analytical as a patient, which is the worst thing you can be. But the idea that you're almost looking at which way he's deciding to go as a therapist and almost in a way second guessing it.
Right. I think it's hard to go into the therapy room as a therapist and not think about why they're saying what they're saying or what they're doing and almost backseat driving, like, I don't know if I would have done it that way, or, you know, I wouldn't have said that right then. And yet what he did was very effective, so much so he was much more experienced than I was at the time. I should mention I was a newer therapist at the time that I went to him. And it was interesting because I would go straight from his office where he would say something that I thought was very important. And I would say the same thing 5 hours in a row right after that to my patients because it was so helpful for me that I wanted to share it. Of course, I didn't attribute it to my therapist.
Yeah, well, that's shared experience, right? That's the idea.
Right.
It's interesting that in the book, and you talk about this a lot, that shared connection or our story as we move forward. When you first met Wendell, you weren't necessarily bowled over by him, and not exactly what you thought of a therapist.
Yeah, he seemed like he came from Therapist Central casting. He was the guy in the khakis and the loafers and the cardigan, you know, the stooped posture. But that didn't matter to me so much. It was just sort of an observation that I think we make these snap judgments about our therapist. Will they understand me? Do I have a lot in common with them? How will they understand my experience if they're different from me? And I think that kind of washes away once you get to know the person.
How long did it take you for you to recognize that you were judging him, that I'm not sure if this guy's got what it takes to be my therapist?
I think that it didn't take that long. I think that once you start talking to someone and you realize that they really do understand, and also they're calling you on your BS, that you respect them more for that. They're doing it in a gentle way, what I like to say, you know, delivering a compassionate truth bomb. But you're going for that. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. Why are you going there if someone's just going to be your yes person?
Lori Gottlieb's my guest. She's the author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. She's in town. We will continue our conversation here on Extension 720 right after the break. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, author Lori Gottlieb. She's the author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. A fascinating look at therapy, but also your particular situation where you went from therapist to patient. We're just talking about it. You wrote a piece in The Atlantic just recently about your first experience as a therapist, and it's being shared widely. It's I've several different people talking about it. This idea that it's anything goes in this room. You can prepare to be a therapist, to go through all the clinical stuff, all the master's degrees you can have, everything that you put into a chair, but you have to be ready for the curveballs.
Yeah, I think that what happens in the therapy room, it's kind of like if you're learning piano and you learn all the scales, but then what happens when you need to improvise? And you get better at it. And my very first therapy session was a little bit of a disaster, or at least I thought it was, because I was talking to this woman who was very distraught. And at a certain point, I was supposed to fill out an intake form, and I was getting none of the information that I needed. And I worried that I was going to get fired from my job on the first day. And then I look at the clock and it's only 10 minutes after the hour. And I think, well, surely we've been in here for more than 10 minutes. And then a few minutes later, I look again and it's 10 minutes after the hour. And I realize that the batteries are out in the clock and I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Should I just say our time is up randomly? Have I gone over because I know I have my second new patient waiting for me in the waiting room?
They don't teach you in the classroom.
They don't. And I think that, you know, you learn a lot from these experiences. You learn so much too. I think one of the things I always tried to do early on as a therapist was I thought that insight was so important. So we now say insight is the booby prize of therapy, that you can have all the insight in the world, but if you don't make change out in the world, then the insight is useless. If you have a problem in your marriage and you know why you do what you do, but you go home and you do exactly the same thing
over and over and over, right?
What's the point of the insight?
I wrote all these things down because they're things I've been in therapy and I never knew what to call them. But at least I had an understanding, reading your book, have an understanding of things like the presenting problem, or like I mentioned, unreliable narrators or patterns and struggles and all these things that are mentioned. Why don't we start with presenting problem? That's what gets you in the room.
Yeah, the presenting problem is the reason you came. And usually the reason you came is a sign of something deeper, a struggle or pattern that got you into that situation in the first place. And so I'm listening not just to what the presenting problem is. I like to say that I'm listening to the music under the lyrics. If the lyrics are, I came here because of a breakup, what is the music under that? What is the pattern or struggle that got you into that situation?
And then identifying that as the stories continue to tell, that's an unreliable narrative. But the idea of the patterns and struggles will present themselves to you as the patient continues to come back and come back.
Yeah, they will. And I think that that's what's going to be most helpful for the patient, is seeing not just what happened in this one situation, but how you can figure out why this happened so that it doesn't happen in the future.
Your situation is you went in for a breakup and you talked to Wendell. And there was something right off the bat where he was kind of grabbing your attention with this idea, this notion that maybe you weren't here necessarily for the breakup, but you're worried about something else. And that grabbed your attention quickly.
It did. He said that I made this comment that I said, well, now half my life is over. And he just glommed onto that. And I really didn't want to go there. But he was saying, you know, I think you might be grieving something bigger than the breakup. And I thought, well, what is he smoking? But he was right. And, you know, it turned out there were a lot of things that I wasn't telling him, not because I was being secretive, but because I think there are all kinds of secrets that we keep and that people keep from me in the therapy room. There are the secrets that we keep from the world and the secrets we keep from people close to us. But there are also the secrets we keep from our therapist and the secrets we keep from ourselves. And there were a lot of secrets that I was keeping from myself that then once I was more aware of them, I was keeping from him, because there's so much shame. I think that we want our therapist to like and respect us, and we feel so much shame around the truth of our lives.
And in your case, you know, as you talk about the presenting problem, it's really about the journey and where you move from that. You having all of this information and knowing this, that's the connection to this book, is that even as someone who knows all of the steps that go into this, you're having these epiphanies, this idea that maybe he's right, or I wasn't thinking this way. He really did change the way you were looking at your own life.
He really did, and he did it in a way that I hadn't done in the therapy room as a clinician, which really helped me to grow as a clinician. He really brought his whole personality into the room. You know, he was a little unconventional. He was very boundaried. He never disclosed anything about his personal life, but he was very open about what he was thinking or feeling in the moment. And he would even bring in cartoons. He brought in this great cartoon of, it was a therapist who, I mean, sorry, it wasn't a therapist. It was a prisoner who was shaking the bars in a prison. And to his right and his left, the bars were open. And he was just trying to say that sometimes we feel trapped, but yet the solution, the way out, is right there. We just aren't looking at it. And we feel trapped by our childhoods or our past or our fears or our circumstances. And yet the sides are open. Why don't we want to walk out?
Yeah. There's another anecdotal story about when you were complaining about suffering. And he got up from his chair. I'll let you tell the anecdote. But very unconventional. But
he did. I was going on and on about... You know, these ideas that I had about my boyfriend had moved on, and I was making this all up based on whatever I saw on social media. And he just came over and he very lightly kicked me, and then he smiled, and then he went and sat back down. And I was like, what did you just do? And he said, well, there's a difference between pain and suffering. We all experience pain, but you don't have to suffer so much. Mm. And sometimes we think other people are the cause of our suffering, but sometimes we are the cause of our suffering. So it's very human to experience pain, but sometimes we don't have to participate in our suffering so much.
Yeah, and the quote that also was not long after in the book was the idea that the truth does not change according to our possibility to stomach it. That's a great way to look at therapy, is that a lot of it is when we're ready to see what the truth is, right? The idea that we're blinded to it, and then when it's there, it's there. But a lot of times we're just uncomfortable by what the truth might be.
That's right. And I think when people come to therapy, there's a certain readiness to see the truth. I always ask when they come, not just why are you here, but why now? Why this week, this month, this year did you pick up the phone, even though this problem might have been going on for longer? I'm scanning for strengths as much as I'm looking for what's not working. And one strength is, how ready are they to hear something? How ready are they to then take that knowledge and change?
This experience is one that ends in there's an arc in the book to it, but it stays with you because you wrote it down and you're sharing it and we're talking about it. You're on the tour talking about this experience. Does that make it more accessible to you, the fact that it'll always be there because you made it something?
I wanted to make it something because I wanted people to start having conversations about what's going on internally with them. I think that we value emotional health so differently from the way we value physical health. So if you're having, you know, chest pains, you're probably going to go get that checked out by a cardiologist before you have a massive coronary. But if you are experiencing something feels off emotionally, or you're experiencing emotional pain, often people don't come to therapy until they're having the equivalent of an emotional heart attack. And I feel like it's harder to treat when they come in at that point. And they've also suffered unnecessarily for a long time when they could have come earlier. So I really want people to see themselves in these stories, in my story and in the other patients' stories, and to find something, like a lot of people are saying, oh, I'm like that, or I know someone who's like that. And it makes them feel less isolated in their circumstances and potentially more able to reach out.
There's something you mentioned, insight, you know, this idea, but a lot of times people think that they're going to get a light's going to go off, a light bulb's going to go off, and they're going to fix all their problems. And they got their three sessions in, and they feel good about the world. And that's what they expect. Or maybe that's their expectations of what therapy is. But it really is a journey, and it's not necessarily something that, like a heart attack, that you go ahead and, you know, open up an artery and everything's going to be okay.
I think that's true, but I also think that people have this misconception that you're going to go to therapy and end up there for years. And that's not the case. It can be, but that's up to you. But I think for most people, whatever they're coming in for, usually they can make a lot of improvement in a certain amount of time. That doesn't mean they're going to be there for the rest of their lives. And it's not like you're going to sit there and talk about your childhood the whole time right. either. I think we talk about our childhoods as a way to understand why we are the way we are in the present. Patterns, and then we right. can write a new chapter for the future.
I love it. Lori Gottlieb's here. She's the author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. She's my guest here in Extension 720. We'll take a break. We'll get the news. We'll come back and we'll continue the conversation with Lori here on Extension 720. Welcome back to Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman here on 720 WGN. Lori Gottlieb's my guest. She's the author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. She does the Dear Therapist a column at The Atlantic. She's also a New York Times bestselling author. Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and Our Lives Revealed, talking about her story of being a therapist and then a patient, and back to a therapist and a patient. There's a great scene in the book right at the end that really, you say at some point towards the end, you talk about what the search is for. And a lot of times people assume therapy is a search for happiness. But you in this book, and it pulls out that really it's a search for meaning. Explain.
Yeah. So people who search for happiness are kind of setting themselves up for disappointment, because we find happiness mediated through meaning and purpose and connection. And one of the main themes of this book is that we grow in connection with others. And I think that a lot of people are unhappy because they don't have enough connection in their mm-hmm. lives. No matter what people come in for, they talk about there's sort of an underlying loneliness, even if they're surrounded by people. And we're so often, you know, with our screens. I think the therapy room is one of the few places where you can sit face to face with another person for 50 minutes straight, hear them breathe, look into their eyes, and not have something pinging or vibrating or dinging, or the phones on the table at the restaurant, or the screens on the walls, and really listen to each other and hear. But so many people don't do that. Yeah. And so I think that they're searching for some idea of happiness that doesn't really exist. We do feel happy when we have meaning and purpose and connection in our lives. But how to help people to find that is part of what therapy is about.
It seems like every 6 months or so you get a thought piece, maybe in The Atlantic or other places, talking about the loneliness epidemic. And you'll see articles and professors and academics talk about loneliness. Is that, in your estimation, is that where we're at? Are we in it? We have an epidemic of loneliness, and it's causing us to have constant search for something that we don't necessarily know?
There is so much loneliness out there. And I think it has to do, too, with this idea of instant gratification, that it's hard to get to know somebody because we don't spend the time getting to know them. We're texting people instead of going to have coffee with them. We don't take the time to meet new people. We don't have organic ways of connecting with people in the neighborhood or through organizations the way that maybe we used to. So I think a lot of people are having a relationship with their phone, but they're not really having the kinds of relationships that nurture them. You can see when people come in the therapy room, when you're face to face with someone, your heart rate goes down, you breathe more easily. Physiologically, it changes you.
You had mentioned in the article as well, the one about your first experience, this idea of Googling. And you kind of mentioned it too, just because there's the idea of Googling therapists, and that's one thing. But then there's also this idea of the picture that we present ourselves, and whether it be on social media and Facebook or Twitter or whatever, but who we are there as opposed to who we are for real. And you see the difference because you'll be in the room with patients. And this is something that you can constantly tell people. We constantly say that what's actually projected on social media may not be the same thing. Yet we still have these feelings around watching someone else be happy or feeling like that projection is better than me or better than the people around me.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that the reason that we don't Google our patients, well, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons is that the story that they put out there is very different from the story that they're going to tell us. And we really want to hear in their words what they tell us, when they say it, how they present it. That will give us information about them. But I think that a lot of people, even though they know intellectually that Facebook and Instagram are not reality, mm-hmm. I think that it causes a lot of this feeling of missing out, this feeling of alienation, that something must be wrong with my life because I'm not in Hawaii with my family on the beach and we all look beautiful. That's one moment, and it might even be a curated moment.
And it feels like, once again, it kind of falls into what you were just saying about this search for meaning as opposed to a search for happiness. There seems like we're projecting happiness, and then we're chasing happiness, but nobody is actually thinking about how to get to happiness.
You know, my colleague has this theory that she said that when people who are married put, you know, all these, like, all of a sudden they do a burst of these, like, wonderful romantic posts on Facebook. She says 3 months later, you're going to get their splitting up announcement. Now, she was saying that in jest, but I think there's some truth to that why do we need to tell everybody something? If we're really feeling that, if we're really happy about something, why do we need to post that so publicly?
From your profession, too, I wonder how much social media was born of wanting connection. I mean, the reason that it's so popular, the reason that it took off and became a cottage industry, people are taking advantage of the fact that we want to project happiness or we want to search for something. Yeah. There's a reason we use it.
We do, but I think there are some good things about technology. So I'm not anti-technology and I'm not anti-social media. Yeah. But, you know, when I see, for example, in the book, there's this young woman, Charlotte, in her 20s, and she's having trouble. You know, she's hooking up with the wrong guys. And at one point, she's got her thumbs in the air and she's saying, and then he said with her thumbs, and then she said with her thumbs. And I'm like, wait, you had that conversation on text? And she said, yes. And I tried to explain to her that you can't really look into somebody's eyes or see their body language. And she said, without a trace of irony, oh, but we also use emojis. And it's a generational thing. It made me feel very old. But it's a generational thing where people are having relationships mediated through their phones, too. And these are really important conversations that you need to learn to have with somebody so that you can have a real relationship with them.
Is the industry, therapy and just psychotherapy in general, will it have to evolve because of the new ways that generations interact with each other, communicate with each other, the wants and feelings and all the kind of things that happen with a new generation of people because of technology and other things that are happening? Or is it as old as time, meaning that those things are in the way of what we know from our human existence?
I think what we know from our human existence is that we all want to love and be loved. And we all seek that on some deep level. And that's the common denominator amongst people, is what do they want? They want to love and be loved. And sometimes technology and the pace of our lives and the way we live our lives and some of these, again, the search for happiness, all of those things get in the way. And I think people need to really focus on what their core needs are and how to get those.
Back to the book, and we'll finish here. You changed the names. You changed the situation, so we don't know. Even to Wendell, who's the main character, is the therapist that you work with. Have they approached you at all about how they feel about being in the book, or did they know they're in, like, have you changed it enough where they're like, that's not me, or have you gotten any feedback from them?
Yeah, so I first of all, I only wrote about people that I'm no longer seeing because I didn't think that I could work with people and write about them without it somehow impacting the work.
Right.
I didn't want.
And
to
from
risk
the patient
that.
Side, there's a little bit of fear of, like, I hope that they're helping me, but at the same time, I hope they're not retaining this for future use.
I think it would be hard to not have that in the back of their minds or my mind.
Right.
Either. And yes, I got permission and I changed everything. So, you know, and I think anybody who comes to me knows that I was a writer before I was a therapist. And I think they've seen how I've handled writing about patients in the past. And I do it with the utmost respect. If I'm, you know, if there's anyone who's sort of more raw and open in this book, it's me, you know, more than my patients.
Right, right. Lori Gottlieb, thank you so much for being here. And thanks for having the conversation about your new book. Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Lori, thanks for being on Extension 720.
My pleasure.
Text from the conversation, 312-981-7847. I'd love to go to therapy. I believe wholeheartedly in the process. I have my 13-year-old daughter seeing a therapist right now. help with middle school issues. Trouble is, we have limited means and we really can't afford for me to go too. My priority is my daughter, so how could I make it work for me too? Any thoughts? It's a great question. Don't know how. I know insurance covers therapy, and that's been a big issue, obviously, with the way that the rules have changed with insurance. But if it's out of pocket, I believe you could probably go to the company or the therapist that works with your daughter and maybe work out some sort of plan. I'm not sure how that works, but, you know, I'm sure you can barter in therapy. It's like buying a watch on Canal Street. No, I'm not sure how it works, but I know that therapy is covered by insurance, and you just have to do a copay. But you already know that if you have your daughter in therapy. Technically, only a psychiatrist has a patient, has an MD. A therapist has clients, 815 tells me. So I was wrong. I apologize for that. Learn something new every day. Yes, Lori in the book referred to clients. I was saying patients in the interview, so I apologize for that. 312, I loved my therapist. He retired. Now I listen to WGN. 847 says, social media is about detachment, not connection. Huh? I don't know about that. Although I do agree it's that there's detachable moments in social media. But I do think that the whole concept of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all of the like, MySpace and Friendster, was feeding a need for connection. It may be a fake connection. It may not be that was at the core of that. We're kumbaya, we want communities, but they saw a desire in the human condition for connection, and they have exploited it to make money. Now, you get something out of that product, although the old fascinating thing that they say about any product, if you're not paying for it, then you're the product. Your data is being sold to big companies. But the point here is, I wonder, those companies didn't do any, it's not like technology was like the biggest thing since the toilet, Facebook. There was something about the desire, the human condition for us to connect, that made that platform work and continue to work. That's why you still use it.
Yeah, I love connecting with people on social media. Yeah. The problem I have is connecting with people in real life.
Yeah.
Like I'll be out and I'll see somebody and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm Facebook friends with that person, and then just, you know, that's good enough. It's always weird. Like, hey, yeah, we're Facebook friends. I think I've liked a post of yours.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before too. It's gotten to the point where it's so personal and people are so overshare in some ways that when you see them, you feel like you've shared intimate moments or creeped on their intimate moments. That's always what gets me, is the idea that I'll run into someone, a coworker somewhere else, and be like, oh yeah, hey, how's it going? How was the gym? Whatever you posted, and I accidentally saw. How was the workout the other day? That's right. Just because I follow you on Instagram and you showed a picture of you working out. Yeah, that's the part where it's almost where I would think that there's this false connection. Because let's be honest, if you saw this person in the gym, you wouldn't actually talk to them. You would walk, or you pretend like you're really, really trying to hit that treadmill.
There's a guy at the gym that I'm friends with for some reason, and he likes like what I'll post or something, and he'll always, then, you know, when I see him, he'll actually ask. He'll ask about something, you know, like, hey, I saw you post that you're at the Cubs game. You know, what do you think? Or he might not even say, I saw you post. He'll say, so how was the Cubs game? And I always think that's a little weird. But at least he's making the effort.
I ran into a friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, Jen Sabella, not too long ago. She's in the Illinois Center here. And she's one of the editors for Block Club.
Yeah.
I just saw her in the Pedway walking by, and I've known her for years.
She's great.
Yeah, she's great. And I ran into her, and we hugged and said, hey, you guys are in this building. That's great. Oh, we're over here, blah, blah, blah. And I said to her, I go, something good just happened to you And I was referring, I saw it on Instagram, but I couldn't remember, I couldn't recall. My brain didn't work for me to go, oh, I saw it. And I was like, what happened to you? Like, that's generically what I said to her, which was, you had things happen and you told us about it. What were they? And congratulations. And it's just so random. And she's like, I'm moving or something like that. And then I was on the plane, went out to Colorado this weekend, and I picked up a Chicago magazine. And there was 17 people to watch, and Jen was in it, and it was great. And that's what I recalled with. I'm like, oh, dope! She put up the picture of the Chicago magazine spread.
At least you didn't say that. You were like, oh, did something, you know? So, and she's like, oh, was it my Chicago magazine
spread?
Yeah,
right.
And then you're like, no, not that.
Not that. It was your cat.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, but it's just that's part of, we have this connection. But there, I feel like if I truly had seen Jen and you know, had seen the magazine, I don't know, I feel like it would have been more authentic than me just going, you generically did this. Anyway. All right, coming up, speaking of connection, and we've been having this conversation tonight about talk the talk and walk the walk. The next story we're going to talk about at the top of the 9 o'clock, right after the news, is a story that I think connects a lot of Chicagoans. That's the story of Wax Trax Records. Wax Trax was both a record label and, of course, a record store on Lincoln Avenue in Lincoln Park. And it was from 1978 to 1992 is the years on this. The store might have been open a little bit longer, but that was the length of the record label. And the bands that came out of that time were bands like Ministry, Front 242, the industrial music and experimental punk scenes in Chicago. And the reason it's funny because I put up on social media, speaking of social media, that we are going to be talking about the documentary, Industrial Accident, and also talk with Julia Nash, who is the daughter and the director of this documentary, but she's the daughter of Jim Nash, who's one of the co-founders of Wax Trax Records. And the response was sentimental. I mean, the people on Twitter that liked and retweeted or made a comment or on Facebook, they were talking about their experiences with Wax Trax Records. And this concept of having an attachment to a business, having an attachment to a moment in time. And Wax Trax Record is that. I was just thinking about that because I had to piece it together. I had the story where when I was doing the research on this, I was like, I have my own personal story where I remember I was at Columbia College, and this would have been the early 90s, around 91, 92, something like that. And I was commuting in from Wonder Lake, Illinois. I had yet to move to Chicago. So I would take the Metro train from Crystal Lake, and I would take it into Chicago, and I would go to school, and then it was almost like a 9-to-5 job. And then I'd pick all my classes so that I could be on the 5:30 train home, which would get me home at like 10 o'clock at night, because it's so far away when you're talking about train to car. So anyway, I remember I got into this intro to a radio class, something at Columbia College, and I think it was the second class, or maybe it was second class, like Tuesday and Thursday class. So the Thursday, I had a class with a friend of mine, or I befriended a guy in the first class. I was like, hey, Mike, hey, I'm Justin, yeah. So on Thursday, we were in the first class and the second class. He turns to me right before we go into the second class, and goes, you want to skip? And I'm like, you can't skip. You know, what if the guidance counselor catches you? And I'm like, oh, wait, this is college. This is brand new. It's irresponsible, but he was like, let's get out of here. Let's go. You want to go up to Lincoln Park? And I was like, oh, yeah, sure, why not? You know, like, this was the plan all along. I'm such a bad kid. When I'm already thinking, oh, man, I'm wasting money. You know, like, this is a class. This teacher's going to hate me. So he had a car. We got it out of the lot and drove up to Wax Trax. And that was the first time I had been in Wax Trax because I didn't live in Chicago. I'd actually been to Wax Trax before. I had a friend who was at DePaul. But it was like on my own where it was like during the day. It was a Thursday at 3 o'clock or something. I walked in there. And that memory sticks with me as a moment of almost independence.
Yeah.
I could do whatever I want now. I'm an adult. I should go to class. There's no doubt. I paid for that class and I'm going to get docked. But don't have to. It's not like high school where you're going to get detention. And there I was, you know, which I felt like I was doing something sneaky, but I was in Wax Trax.
Yeah, I have a similar experience with that. I was living at home going to Loyola for a while, and same thing. I would take the Metro down to the downtown campus, drive to LaGrange, park, then, you know, take the Metro. And some days, you know, just don't feel like doing it.
Right.
You know, but then you're like, okay, you know, my mom's not expecting me back until 2:30. What am I going to do for 5 hours? I'm gonna drive downtown and go to a record store and, right. and peruse.
Peruse. When perusing was...
Because you can't come back with anything.
Right, right. Perusing was a two-hour affair.
Yeah.
Right? Perusing now is us looking at our phones and scrolling as fast as we can. Perusing at the record, that was an art form.
Yeah.
But Wax Trax record and Ministry as well, that band, I saw Ministry at one of the Lollapaloozas at Alpine Valley. I forgot which one they were on, like the first and second or third one or something like that. It was truly the scariest moment of my life. They purposely played at dusk. That was their thing. I think they were like the third, like, and they play that industrial kind of hard driving rock music. And I just remember the mosh pit on the hill at Alpine Valley was like huge circle, and it was just got real. I mean, everyone was really getting into it. A lot of elbows flying, and that was the moment where you're like, "All right, this is a real deal. Ministry's a real deal." So that was also a defining moment. So Wax Trax Records and Ministry have a moment in my life, and it'll be great to talk with Julia Nash coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, we're going to talk with Amara Enya, the former mayoral candidate who is our guide for our neighborhood tour tonight. We're in East Garfield Park, West Side neighborhood where she lives. We met at Inspiration Kitchens to talk about the issues of that neighborhood and what keeps her there. So that's coming up as well tonight in the 9 o'clock hour. Stay with us. Thanks, Andrea. Coming up, Amara Enya is going to take us to East Garfield Park. We're going to Inspiration Kitchens over on 3508, I think, 3504 West Lake Street, right by the Garfield Park Conservatory. So we'll have that conversation coming up at 9:30. It's Record Store Day coming up this weekend. This is an annual tradition to celebrate vinyl and independent record stores. In Chicago, there's a long history of great record stores. Oh, my. The list brings a smile to my face. Rose Records, Reckless, Dusty Groove, Pinwheel, Bric-a-Brac, Laurie's Planet of Sound. The list of past and present stores is so impressive. But we may have left out the best of all, Wax Trax. Wax Trax holds a special place in Chicago hearts. Everybody has a story. Jim Nash and Danny Fletcher came to Chicago in 1978. Wax Trax, the store, was on Lincoln Avenue. Wax Trax, the record label, specialized in industrial music and was responsible for bands like Ministry, Front 242, KMFDM, and more. This Saturday, there's a big event at House of Vans in the West Loop, including a performance from the band Ministry, a Wax Trax era set. But the main event will be the screening of the documentary Industrial Accident, the story of Wax Trax Records. In it, Chicago mainstays like Steve Albini, Joe Shanahan, and Al Jorgensen wax poetic about the indie label and the store that put industrial music on the map. The documentary is directed by Julia Nash. Julia Nash is the daughter of Wax Trax founder Jim Nash and now owner of the label, and she's in studio with me tonight. Julie, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
It's a tremendous, I kind of said right before that people have a lot of memories about Wax Trax Records, and it's something that is really a big part of not just the Chicago neighborhood, Lincoln Park, but about music lovers in Chicago. Do you feel that? Do you feel that when wherever you go, the love for Wax Trax?
Definitely. I get emails daily. You know, we have hundreds of emails coming in, like, and people expressing their connection and that whole sort of love and that just great vibe that it gave people when they walked in the door.
For you to have lived that and maybe not be necessarily aware because you grew up in it, because you go back to 1978 and it's 1978 to the early 90s. Did you know that at the time that what was happening at the store, what was happening at the label?
No clue. It's really very similar. I mean, what your parents did you really know or care? No, probably not. I think one thing that sort of resonated with me was I grew up primarily in Kansas City, or Kansas, I should say, a small town, Topeka, Kansas. So coming to Chicago and going into the record store, always gave me a feeling of like, these are my people, this is where I need to be. So that sort of like spurred me to get out of high school as quick as I could. So I graduated early and moved up here. Sad for my mom, of course, because that was a terrible, terrible departure. Yeah. Because it was just heartbreaking. I wish she could live with me now. Anyway, so just coming up here and feeling that when I was in the store, I thought I felt that, and everyone out here just kind of knew it was like fun and great and whatever and just always belonged, but I felt really like this is where I need to be. And it did not hit me until I heard that from other people, and fans coming up to me, which really started during the retrospectacle at the Metro in 2011.
You know, to look at the trailer for the documentary and see all the different people talking about and some of the archival footage of your dad, but also just the presence of the store and the label, there you do get a vibe that it was a place. So take us to that place. What was the Wax Trax? What was Wax Trax Records like in, say, the middle of the 1980s?
Oh, gosh. You know, I guess you could sum it up. It was like a nightclub during the day, maybe. You know, it was a place that, at least for me, in coming from Kansas, I had never been in a place that people were smoking pot, you know, drinking beer, doesn't, you know, whatever. Listening to all great music the whole time. It was magical. It really, truly was. Just walking in, it was just like so much everywhere. It was just totally like overload, but also just a very calm place at the same time. It's very hard to explain.
Well, beyond the space, and we'll get back to the reminiscing of the space, but the industrial music, it's experimental punk at that time. The community... There were communities all over the country that were kind of playing, and around the world, really, when you think about industrial music. But it was Wax Trax Records that kind of brought that together, that all these bands, from Ministry and to some of the Front 242, some of these bands that I've mentioned, they all kind of come together under this umbrella. Talk about the label and its role in creating not just a scene, but a movement.
Geez. You know, I think it definitely was not a planned circumstance. It was an accident. So, you know, it was really just my dad kind of giving that sort of like playground and creative space for people, and being able to push that to the surface to where other people could kind of recognize it, notice it, and grab onto it and create from that moment on.
It's
hard because I was also, like I said, you know, and like you said, I was living it as a kid and kind of growing up with it. So those things kind of didn't even sort of faze me at all. And it's weird to say that because, yeah, you're, you know, having dinner with the lead singer of the Psychedelic Furs or, you know, the Cars or whatever. And it's just none of it is kind of...
Yeah, it can't be nostalgic in the moment. You don't even know the moment, right? For you to make this project a reality, to the documentary, and to take the step to go from not just archiving what your dad and what Danny did, and that was a big part of what you and your husband do, is to get get Wax Trax on the record, but making it
pun.
I know, right? That's a good pun. But making the documentary, what does it mean to you? What does it mean to you to go from just someone who wants to make that space for your dad and now in a place where you're actually telling the story of Wax Trax Records?
Really what it means to me, quite honestly, it was a gift to be able to give back to all of the people that were so touched by it. It was a gift for the rest of my family and Danny's family, our families, just to kind of like, you know, document all of that and what they had done and the lives they had touched and the music they put on the map and Chicago they put on the map for that matter. That kind of was the vibe.
Julia Nash is my guest. She is the daughter of Wax Trax founder Jim Nash. She's going to be showing her documentary at the House of Vans coming up on Saturday, which is Record Day, Record Store Day here in Chicago. The of course, the documentary, which will be shown, is called Industrial Accident, the story of Wax Trax Records. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More with Julia here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Talking Wax Trax Records tonight. Record Store Day is on Saturday, and a big show at House of Vans, which is a new venue, skate park in the West Loop. I don't know much about it. I got to go over there. But the
awesome space.
Is it?
Yep.
So House of Vans will be the hosting a Record Day affair, if you will. That'll be a screening, a Q&A, and a performance by Ministry of Wax Trax era set. Wax Trax era set, right?
Yep.
Because Ministry is one of those bands where there was a moment they were on the label, and then they moved on. They moved on, and some of the more popular songs that you would know Ministry from was when they hit a major label or after Wax Trax.
Depends on what kind of music you like.
That's right. That's right. Julia Nash is in studio. Her documentary will be screened at this event as well. It's called Industrial Accident, the Story of Wax Trax Records. Julia is the daughter of Jim Nash, one of the co-founders of Wax Trax, who came here from Denver in 1978. And, you know, you think of the record label, and I don't know why, but I just figured it was we're celebrating 40 years of Wax Trax. But it kind of fizzled out in the early 90s and went away. You've resurrected it, but what happened at that moment where they decided to close up shop?
Oh, my God. That is a whole big story you would need a long time on air for, and you'd be bored probably. But, you know, my dad was sick and really just was kind of reevaluating things. And obviously music business had changed. A lot of the bands had left because there weren't contracts. And he really just, you know, family was everything to him, whether it was his Wax Trax family, his family. Mm-hmm. And so at that point I had a daughter, and he really was way into being a grandfather. So he really kind of was like, this is like, we're nearing the end of my life. So let's hang, you know.
There was something to be said about Wax Trax being a place, and it shows up in the documentary that you did, just about a place where anyone can come. And there was a lot of inclusion. This could be anyone from Dave Grohl, who's in the documentary, to Al, or to Steve Albini, or Joe Shanahan. All these people talking about almost a home away from home. Was that the intention? Was the intention to make it this place where anyone can come in there, you know, just sort of, you can get away, and Wax Trax is almost like your playhouse?
I don't think it was an intention. Again, another accident. You know, really, my dad was, it was just an inclusive, like you said, space. You know, you had attorneys next to punk rockers next to, you know what I mean? Artists next to, you know, rockabilly fans next to, I don't know, Doris Day fans. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, it really was just one big family, honestly. That's really like the best word I could use to describe it.
You and your husband have both been
working your butts off.
But you're dedicated to chronicling and archiving the life of what your dad created. In doing so, you've gone differently. You went to Danny Fletcher's place after he passed not too long ago to just kind of get this stuff together about the story of Wax Trax. What did you find? What did you find that surprised you from going into the archives of both your dad and Danny?
I think not just archival surprises, but just the fact that certain things were kind of like untouched in a way. So, for example, in one little shack type barn, we found, you know, their entire CD collection still in the, like, some bad Ace Hardware. Remember, they used to have furniture and stuff. So it was like very 80s CD rack, and it had all of their CDs in it with the divider cards still in it, and just kind of like basically transported from their living room and into this little barn, decrepit barn. So those kinds of things shocked me. The fact that, you know, the sign from the store that was hanging on the building was in this barn. These guys collected everything and didn't throw anything away. So as can I swear? Sorry. Anyway, I guess that is probably the most
surprising.
Yeah, it was a big deal. But then archivally, you know, like I said, they saved everything.
Right.
So we're talking check stubs for like artists that they paid, or you know what I mean? So there's just like a lot.
In putting together the documentary and getting so many artists who were involved with Wax Trax back in the day to talk about it, was it hard to get them on the record to talk about Wax Trax, or was this something they've been waiting to talk about?
It wasn't hard, I think, because, you know, again, I say family, and that's what came up even in all of these interviews. So it was either Jim and Danny were like my parents, they were like my brothers, they were, you know, so everyone really felt related. It's weird to say, I guess, but there was definitely a closeness in all of the relationships, and a lot of these people I still talk to and have talked to throughout the years. Some I haven't in many, many years. It was great to reconnect. But yeah, everyone was on board to talk, and it's a shame that we couldn't travel like all over and nonstop, because there were people that we obviously missed because they're so far away.
One of the in reading about the story and learning more about your dad, is just about his sexuality, which came out about him being gay. And this was not something that necessarily was upfront with him. It wasn't something that he led with, if you will, at Wax Trax. Right. He wasn't
marching in the parade. Or
right.
Anything.
But there's something to be said. And you referenced this in an interview about, you know, almost pushing back on the stereotype of what, you know, what a gay man is, especially like in the 80s, and for him to be such a influential and really active and forward-looking member of experimental punk scene, industrial music scene, where that stereotype is not necessarily there. There is something to be said that he pushed a movement forward with the way that he presented himself and who he was in an industry that didn't necessarily have a lot of gay contributions.
I mean, sure. He, you know, he really did not care about any of that. He didn't. And again, back to, you know, the clientele that shopped at the store, there was no judging, I guess. You know, I mean, God, people who know his sense of humor, that they're laughing at me now. But, you know, there was no agenda. He wasn't, again, waving any flags, marching in any parades. Not that he didn't support and love right. and care about that community, but that wasn't what matters. Who you are, what you do, your sexuality, the color of your skin, none of that matters. What matters is music and how it moves you. And that's it.
What's next for Wax Trax? Now that you are in control of one of the best brands in Chicago history, but overall, what is the plan for the record label?
Oh my God. You know, to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure yet. Really, we've been working so hard, nonstop, while having other jobs, and like really just focusing on getting this out. And it is a major feat for this core group of people that have worked together. Like literally, you can count it on one hand. I think the first thing will be to just stop, hopefully, for a little bit.
Take a breath, yeah.
Yeah. Talk to my husband, not like a business partner as much, and deadlines. I don't want to talk about those. I just want to chill.
How are we going to see this? If I can't go to the screening at House of Vans on Saturday, where can I see Industrial Accident, the story of Wax Trax Records?
You could buy it from me tonight. I brought a bag. No, I'm kidding. it releases on the 16th. And, you know, the House of Vans show on the 13th is our very first ever commercial showing of the film.
Wow.
And we're only allowed with our licensing agreement 10 commercial screenings.
Because you've shown it in festivals and other places, but the actual commercial showings, that's a different story.
Yeah, so this is the first one ever. Wow. So it's a big, big deal.
Are you nervous? As a filmmaker, you've already seen audiences respond to it.
I'm nervous every single time, actually. Like, I am like, are they going to laugh at the right parts? Are they going to, like, think this is good? Do they get it? Is this all right? Are they going to be pissed because there's not enough about the certain band in it? You know, you're always nervous. But it's really been amazing, the response, walking out of there and people really enjoy it, and that means the world to me.
Julia Nash, the daughter of Jim Nash, who was one of the co-founders of Wax Trax Records, is also the director of the new documentary Industrial Accident, the story of Wax Trax Records. There's going to be a big show at the House of Vans in West Loop this Saturday for Record Store Day. There's going to be the screening of the film, also a Q&A, and Ministry is going to perform a set of Wax Trax era songs. A great event. What time does it start?
I don't know, actually. No, I'm kidding. I believe doors are at 5:30. The screening is at 6. And then everything sort of like flows after that.
Tumbles after that, right?
A pop-up shop, so we'll have a lot of our like Wax Trax merch and like kind of walking into the old store.
That's great.
It'll be a lot of fun.
That sounds wonderful. That's Saturday in honor of Record Store Day. Julia Nash, thanks so much for being my guest today on Extension 720.
Thank you.
It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chicago, 77 little towns under one umbrella. Is Chicago a city of neighborhoods? Well, we intend to find out. We continue our tour of Chicago tonight by going west to East Garfield Park. East Garfield Park is smack dab in the middle of the west side of Chicago. North to Chicago Avenue, south to 290, the Green Line rumbles through the neighborhood, which obviously is home to Garfield Park and the Garfield Park Conservatory. The conservatory draws tourists from all over the world, but those tourists don't stick around to take in the local fare. The neighborhood is predominantly African American and hasn't seen much development since the 1968 riots. And the area is one of the hotspots for Chicago's gun violence. As a matter of fact, even today, a shooting took place just mere blocks from where we were. It's no joke. But the architecture along the boulevards, amazing. And Garfield Park itself is one of Chicago's crown jewels. And according to Real Estate News, the prices in the area, they're on the way up. Politically, it's the 28th Ward, run by Alderman Jason Irvin, and it's also represented by longtime Congressman Danny Davis. And speaking of politics, my tour guide of East Garfield Park today is former mayoral candidate Amara Enya. Enya ran for mayor in the general but didn't make the runoff, but she did make headlines for a high-profile endorsement from Chance the Rapper. But before this campaign, Amara was an activist, an educator, and a frequent guest on my old show. She picked a place, the Inspiration Kitchen, located in the 3400 block of Westlake Street. The place is part catering kitchen, restaurant, and community center, built and run to help people in East Garfield Park find employment and stability. And they make a mean shrimp po' boy. What do we need to know? Let's first talk East Garfield Park. Of course, Chicagoans are going to know the conservatory, and that's a big part of this area. I mean, it's the big acres alone. It's the spot. But what do people need to know about East Garfield Park?
Well, I would say it's just such an absolutely beautiful neighborhood. I think it's a hidden gem. Even having the conservatory here, beyond that, we have some of the most amazing housing stock in the city. If you drive through the neighborhood, you'll see the gray stones. You'll see they're like townhouses along the boulevards.
It's great.
We've got the park. We've got the Golden Dome. It's an absolutely gorgeous neighborhood. I think it's a hidden gem.
Now, the park separates Garfield Park. You got a west and an east. What's the difference? Is there a difference in the demographics, in the economy, and how those neighborhoods are doing?
Well, the difference would be mainly that in East Garfield Park, years ago, there was some gentrification taking place closer to the eastern border of the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that has slowed. And so the demographics are pretty much the same, both primarily black neighborhoods. I would say you'll see in West Garfield Park a lot of residential single-family homes, mm-hmm. More so, I think, than East Garfield. East Garfield, we've got a lot of the sort of townhouse sort of streets going on. But the demographics are pretty much the same. They've got, you know, a lot of challenges, some of the same challenges mm-hmm. as it relates to employment levels in the community and some of the, you know, things like shootings and things like that that right. you'll see pretty similar across both East and West Garfield. But even in West Garfield, I mean, if you drive down Washington Boulevard, I mean, the homes are just amazing. It's, I don't know, it's just really quality homes. It's really nice. I like the access to the park, and mm-hmm. it's also very transportation friendly.
Yeah, as we sit right here, right in the shadow of the Green Line, which is flying by as yes. we're having our conversation. The one thing that I will say about Garfield Park, and I've noticed this as well, is that for all the beautiful homes, the other part of it, which is somewhat sad, is just the abandoned lots. There's yes. a lot of abandoned lots, and it's yeah. it's surprising to me that, you know, with Chicago being so expensive, that people would gobble those up. But why are yeah. there so many abandoned lots in both East and West?
Yeah, you'll see, unfortunately, a lot of vacant lots, especially along Madison. If you drive down Madison, you'll see a lot of them. And sort of what the understanding is for folks who live in the neighborhood is that we haven't seen significant development along our major corridor since the 1968 riots after Dr. King was assassinated. And so you haven't seen development happen on the west side, really, since that time. And so you see a lot of these vacant lots. The big question is who owns those lots. If you have outside investors or speculators, folks who are not in the community, so in some cases not even in the city, they can hold... Or even in the country, they can hold on to those vacant properties. And because they're not connected, they're not as vested in making sure that we actually turn those vacant properties right. into assets for the community. So that's been a big challenge from a community and economic development standpoint.
What do you think, what do you say from your point of view is the number one issue for East Garfield Park?
Well, I would say it's one is definitely the levels of violence in the neighborhood, the number of shootings in the neighborhood. It's a lot. It tends to go up and down, but it's probably top five in the city, I think, in terms of the number of shootings. We also have a significant issue with the open-air drug markets, and we're off of 290, off the 290 corridor, which is the heroin highway, is what they say. And so that's very evident in the neighborhood as well. For me, it's a big issue. You see a lot of folks who are dealing with substance abuse problems who clearly have not had access to care, whether physical or mental health care. And you see a lot of folks also who are dealing with mental health issues as well that's going untreated. And so I've seen a lot of that just randomly throughout the neighborhood.
You ran for mayor, and in doing so, you crisscross the city. You're all over the place in different neighborhoods. Are the problems in East Garfield Park, are they similar to the problems in other neighborhoods? Are they relatable problems, meaning things that you see maybe on West Washington Street are the same things you might see on South Halsted Street or North Milwaukee, whatever it might be, but or is it unique?
Yeah, not North Milwaukee, but there are definitely some similarities. So a lot of the things you see with vacant lots, for example, if you go down to Inglewood, you see just open land, right? So you see clearly what happens when you have land, homes that were torn down, development hasn't happened. So there's a similarity there. The employment issue in terms of how many people are actually employed in the community, that's an issue that we're seeing across the city, where people in neighborhoods from, if you go to Little Village, it's the same thing. You go down to Roseland, it's the same thing where the local residents are not benefiting from jobs available in the economy. They're simply not getting access to jobs. And so you see that similarity. So I think broadly there are similarities no matter what neighborhood you go into. Mm-hmm. What's unique though also about East Garfield is we have so many assets that make this a prime area of investment and development. So we've yeah. got these transportation corridors along Madison, along Roosevelt, along Cicero. You know, there's so many options. We have a great park system. We're very close to downtown, just a straight shot, and you're downtown.
I mean, it's amazing to see the skyline.
Yes.
You can almost reach out and touch it from here.
Yes, yeah. yes.
And that's, I think, what I think a lot of Chicagoans and people who might be listening right now are surprised and baffled. I mean, when you see the Garfield Park Conservatory and you know how many tourists come through there. We just walked over there
yeah.
and to see all the people coming out that aren't living in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And you also can reach out and touch and you've got the Green Line right here. You would think that this would be prime location for,
yes.
I don't want to say gentrification, but development.
Yes.
why not?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think it just comes down to priorities. I think that the city has not had a habit of actually investing in an area until people are displaced. And that's one of the big tragedies. The land is valuable. The homes are valuable. The question is always whether the people are valuable. And so long as the people are not valued by the power structure and by city government, then you don't see the kinds of financial and economic investment that could be truly transformative. But if you did it here, I mean, it would work. Like, we have everything that we need to make this a thriving and vibrant community.
Well, you're sandwiched in a way, too, as the Green Line rumbles past us as we talk, between Oak Park and downtown.
Yes.
And there's something that, I guess I it's a rhetorical question, but you just wonder about, just when it comes to discrimination in areas, when it comes to our economy and our housing, to see this is a primarily black neighborhood, and to see on the other sides, Oak Park or downtown, which would be primarily white neighborhoods or white businesses, they're getting development up the wazoo, but there's none here. And that, and it's, when you sit here, it's startling.
Yes, you can actually, you can feel it. The fact that this is sort of like a donut hole. Even if you look at where nonprofit organizations are located, or where, you know, where things are happening, you literally have to either go east or you've got to go west. Right here, there are very few organizations that are here. There are very few resources that are here. It's almost like it's a forgotten part of the city. And that's something that I always try to lift up, because when you actually get here, people are like, wow, this is a really beautiful neighborhood. We've got so many assets. Why aren't we doing more here? Why isn't the city doing more here? And that's what residents are saying. Like, we're deserving of the same level of investment that you see elsewhere. And that infusion of financial capital would actually work here, and it would do a lot for the community.
How do you change it? You didn't win as mayor.
No, so I know.
You got to change your agenda locally, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to keep advocating and lifting it up in the mainstream conversations. Mm-hmm. I was always very clear about running for mayor, but also speaking for those areas that have been sort of overlooked for a very long time, and pushing the West Side into the mainstream conversations so that we're forcing leadership to actually say, maybe we should reevaluate what our economic development strategy is.
Are you optimistic that's going to happen with a new city council and a new mayor, that people are going to look a little bit closer at some of the communities like East Garfield Park?
Yes, I am. I am. I'm very optimistic, because one thing that I know coming out of this election is that people do not want the status quo. They don't want the same things. They're looking for something different. And we also have, in addition to the alderman, we've got a new city council with several new aldermen that have been very vocal, many of whom I know and have worked alongside. And so it's exciting to have their voices now in city council, to be able to support the voices of those of us in the neighborhood. So I'm definitely optimistic.
All right. Well, the Brussels sprouts are here.
Yes, they are phenomenal.
So it's a good place to stop. Amara, great to see you. Thanks for talking East Garfield Park today.
Thank you.
Good to catch up with Amara Enya in East Garfield Park. Tomorrow, we hit Rogers Park, the neighborhood all the way north, borders Evanston. Talk about their issues, their needs, and the change in leadership there as well. So we continue our neighborhood conversations here on Extension 720. Can you say you're listening to Extension 720 on WGN Radio?
I'm listening to Extension 720 on WGN Radio.
Let's do it one more time. Can you say you're listening to Extension 720 on WGN Radio?
I am listening to...
So you say like you're talking to... Extension 720 here. Coming up, Patty Vasquez taking over here at 10 o'clock. I mentioned it right at the beginning of that East Garfield Park story, but we were at Inspiration Kitchens, which was 3504, so Lake Street, 08, something like that. And while we were there, there was a shooting and an actual death just a couple blocks north, Ohio Street, 3400 block of Ohio Street. And I didn't recognize till we got back that we were in that business when that was happening.
It's awful, isn't it?
Yeah, it really does point to what Amara was talking about, that these are big issues in a neighborhood.
Right.
When you have that kind of violence, and it happened exactly where she was talking about the big two issues in East Garfield Park for her, gun violence and open-air drug markets. And those open-air drug markets is where the gun violence happened today.
This is the second time this has happened to us, so maybe it is us. Maybe it's
it
not.
Could be
maybe
us.
It is you.
Yeah, we were down on the south side in South Shore, and 2 days after we were at 71st and Chappelle, someone shot up exactly where we were standing.
You know,
so it could be.
She's a great speaker, by the way, Amara Enya.
Yeah, and, you know, we didn't really talk much about politics because that's not what the segment's about. I wasn't going to be on the record like, Amara, tell me about Lincoln Yards. What do you think about Lincoln Yards?
Right.
What is Lori doing a good job?
Huh, is Lori doing a good job?
What do you think? You know, she'll have plenty of people who want her opinion for that, but this is mainly about talking about neighborhoods and living in East Garfield Park. And it is true, when you go through there, the housing stock that is there and some of the boulevards as you go along Warren and Washington and the west side of Chicago and even Lake Street, which has the Green Line that runs over it, is just a marvel. It's a masterpiece in architecture where it's something that you just don't see anywhere else. Maybe Queens or some of the iconic shots that you'll see in movies. But we go west on Lake Street. It's amazing. And at the same time, you see all of that stuff and tremendous row house or townhome kind of architecture, the graystone, brownstones on the west side. You see a lot of vacant lots, a lot of boarded up businesses or old signs that say muffler shop or store, and then there's nothing there that's been raised. And there has to be something to be said about the impact that has on a neighborhood and its residents, because I can understand the idea of removing some of the vacant homes or businesses and bulldozing them out to just make them vacant lots. But to grow up or to be a part of a community that's the end of it. I it's really hard to fathom, and I'll bet you that has some impact on how you view your own neighborhood and your own home. You know, I live in the West Loop, and in my neighborhood, they're chomping. I got people out in front of me with a jackhammer being like, I'll tear your house down right now and build a bigger one with a lot more glass.
Oh, yeah. That's how it was when I moved to South Loop in 2009. It was still kind of growing. And now, oh, my gosh, you can't step foot without hitting a great restaurant, apartments, condos. It's huge.
And I can't understand, because if you live in, I don't know, Albany Park, we've talked to people in Jefferson Park, Rogers Park even. I think it's similar in the way that if there is a vacant piece of land, there's a grab for that land in some form. And maybe it might be a shoddy condo that gets popped up, or maybe a new cell phone store, something of that nature. But there's something about the west side of Chicago. We saw this too in Inglewood, I don't understand why there isn't more community development. I don't understand why there aren't more Sterling Bays that say, you know what, this is wide open. You know, when we talk about this will be a controversial thing, and we'll be talking about it on the program, especially as the mayor-elect takes over, but the new police academy is another example of where that as you see, that's Jason Irvin, that's the West, it's Emma Mitz, that's the west side of Chicago, and there's talk about trying to build a big, new, shiny development on the west side of Chicago, so I can understand why they would want to do that, because being over there, you get the concept that, you would like to see some more development happen in all Chicago neighborhoods. And just like you said, on just to the west, you're going to get Oak Park. Just to the east, I mean, really, you reach your hand out. And you're already downtown, into the West Loop and downtown. So tell me why an area that's at the 3,000 block of Chicago has such blight. I don't understand. The Garfield Park is unbelievable. Garfield Park Conservatory. Anyway, I'm off my high horse.
No, it's not high horse. It's true, and it's great, because I even drive through some of the neighborhoods and I see these, you know, vacant lot, vacant lot, vacant lot, vacant lot.
Right.
You know?
It just, it blows my mind. It's disproportionate, because you'll have, like I said, there was a brownstone on the corner of my block, and it was small. They raised it.
Yeah.
And they built 4, 6, 8 stories up in the thinnest... You know, like, there's no space in between. They just crammed it as much as they possibly could into one little area. And I know it's all economics. I know it's all money and real estate. I'm not dumb in that regard. But, I mean, really, truly, if you just went 6 to 8 blocks west, you would have a lot more space to build that up and build that out. And this is an interesting... So I was on the plane, and I was looking at Chicago Magazine. And Chicago Magazine has, as you get through, ads for different real estate. You know, I'm the best realtor in town at $1 million deals. And there was one ad that was just a full ad of a new condo building. And it was at the perfect. It was brown and gray and all this, the little fake people that are walking around, you know, that thing. And they like to live an elegant lifestyle right across from the park.
Was it one of those Chicago Magazine ads that you think is an article? They trick you?
No, no, no. This was a straight up ad. Oh. They were going, I know what you're saying. Then I tricked like three times in that. Yeah. But there, all this elegance, all this, oh, a new type of living in the West Loop. That's what they were saying. You know, oh, it's going to be huge and everything was huge. And the address, they put the address on it. The address is less than a block from where I live on the same street. And I was like, wait a second, that's my block. I'm looking at an ad that is essentially talking about elegant living, West Loop lifestyle, where I'm at. So I'm like, is that what's happening, right? It's just, and it's sneaky. It's sneaky in the way that there's an old building there that was a Salvation Army. It was kind of like a halfway house. It's just like that is gone. Like I drove past it today when I was coming back, and I'm like, oh, yeah, it's boarded up.
Like, so are they going to make this a new
they're
development?
They're
going
to tear that down and build a whole new development and act like nothing had ever been there before. But I didn't notice it as a neighbor. I'm like, there's nowhere to build on this. There's nowhere to build here.
Mm-hmm.
But they had taken something that had been there way before I came to the West Loop and generations helping people I think it was transition from jail, whatever it might be. But that building like that is gone. And there are already ads in the Chicago Magazine saying what it's going to be.
Wow.
It's crazy. I mean, it looks nice. I was looking really close. I was like, maybe I'm one of those fake people who are down at the bottom, you know, playing with the dogs, you know, whatever it was.
You're like, well, I need a dog. Exactly. Do you have a dog?
I do not.
Okay.
I have two cats. Cat person. I wish they were like dogs, though. I'm always like, come here. Hey, hey.
Nothing. They're like, I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
They walk away.
All right. Coming up, Patty Vasquez. Stay with us.